Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Kathleen Lord, registration number 14190. Given the complexity and number of issues raised by Mr. Parra, it was very tempting not to ask for oral argument and to rely on the brief. However, because everyone's entitled to a fair trial, and I believe that strongly, and I am concerned because of the breadth and depth of inadmissible evidence that was introduced at trial, that not only was Mr. Parra denied his right to a fair trial, but in reading the cold record, he may also be denied his right to a fair appeal. I want to start by addressing some of the issues the prosecution has ignored in briefing that go to the fairness of the proceedings, and if I have time, to the elemental kidnapping instruction. I first want to talk about issues pertaining to Jeremy Parra, Mr. Parra's brother. I want to refer the court to the questioning by the prosecution, both of Jeremy Parra and of the detective who interviewed Mr. Parra, about whether his brother, my client, could have an entire second life that he didn't know about, or an entire secret life that he knew nothing about. And I addressed that issue in argument 6B1 and in argument 3. It seems plain that such testimony is wildly speculative and inadmissible. Nevertheless, it came in at Mr. Parra's trial. His brother Jeremy, through no fault of my client Mr. Parra, was required to testify in shackles and handcuffs.
Excuse me, counsel, if I can just focus on that point. The Attorney General kept saying that there was no evidence that he was in shackles and clothing and in jail garb. The record didn't reflect that. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is that in closing argument, defense counsel makes reference to it, and in my rebuttal, I can give you the cite to that. And also, in context, when the judge is addressing the issue and leaves to the unfettered discretion of the sheriffs whether to keep Mr. Parra, Jeremy Parra, in shackles, it's clear in context that he's not being unshackled. So I think the combination of factors show on our record that Jeremy Parra was shackled, and also the court recognized that there was no security risk. There was no reason to have the only family member who testified at Mr. Parra's trial testify in a way that, you know, undermined his exculpatory evidence and made the Parra family seem less than the rest of us. And you have to look at that issue also in combination with the objections to Mr. Parra, Christopher Parra, being shown at length in jail clothes to the jury on the videotape statement, and also into the on the photograph that was shown CC for identification purposes.
Wasn't there an explanation by the trial court judge why Jeremy Parra was dressed in jail clothing and shackled? Didn't the trial court tell the jury that he failed to appear and that's why he was in that circumstance?
My memory, and I will check on that in the interim, in the break, is that the court said, and I'm not sure if it was in the hearing of the jury, that we all know, we don't have to hide that he's been arrested. We all know that he's been arrested. But whether he gave, I don't believe he gave an explanation to the jury, but I will confirm that before
may
the
not,
today.
I may not be remembering that correctly. Maybe it was that I was thinking about, that he did explain he has been arrested. That's why he's dressed and shackled in this manner.
I don't know that he gave an explanation. I'd also like to focus, and I have so little time, but I want to focus on the juror question that never should have been asked, and that's addressed in argument 4. And the unfair inference that was drawn from that question was exploited in closing argument. And basically, as the court knows, a statement of Mr. Parra, his interview with police, was played for the jury. It was heavily redacted to remove references to sex offender registry, prior allegations and convictions of burglary and rape. So we have a statement, and the transcript of it is found at page 461 of the record. And what happens is the police, after Mr. Parra, unbeknownst to him, has been arrested for this offense, start out the interrogation saying, your name has come up in an assault case, and we know you are a registered sex offender. Okay? The part about registered sex offender is redacted for obvious reasons. So all the jury hears is, your name has come up in an assault case. After 151 lines of text or a transcript, Mr. Parr asks, quote, is this a rape case? Now, in the middle of that, there about 35% of the substantive material, i.e. not the Miranda warning, not the unshackling on tape of Mr. Parra, about 35% of that is all dealing with rape and sex offender registration. But the jury doesn't hear that. So a juror asks a question at the conclusion of the testimony of the detective and says, during the interview with the defendant, did you, Mr. Detective, indicate that it was a rape investigation at any time before the defendant asks you, is this a rape? And the juror is the one who underlines and emphasizes at any time. The defense objects to that question being asked in light of the redactions. The court allows it to be asked, and the detective, when asked that, says no. So he tells the jury that at no time, not at any time, did he ever indicate this was a rape case. Now, that would be bad enough, because it's pretty clear that the juror is asking a question that's designed to confirm guilty knowledge.
Why would that be, in your words, bad enough if it was an accurate response by the detective?
Because, Your Honor, it's not an accurate response.
Well, from my reading of the record, I think the detective said something about, as you indicated, and we know you're a sex offender, but that doesn't indicate that the detective asked the defendant anything about this being a rape case.
Well, Your Honor, and I would refer the court to page 461 through 470 or thereabouts of the record in the pleadings volume. And when you look at the material that's redacted, the court, the detective saying, I know you have a case from, where was it, Oklahoma? Okay, when did the Oklahoma case happen? And what sort of case was that? It was a rape case. Let's see. And the detective expressly elicits this information. That's at page 469. The defendant's talking about his arrest and starting at the outset saying, we know you're on a sex offender registry. The whole, first of all, assault is a little ambiguous to start out with. It could be rape, it could be non-rape. It's for the common man, it's ambiguous. And then when you couch it in all this information about prior rapes that the officer knows about, to answer the question of the juror, did you in any way indicate this was a rape case before the defendant asked you about it? And for the officer to say no, I suggest that is misleading. And if there's any doubt about it, you go to the closing argument. And as this court is well aware, you know, advocates tend to save their toughest punches for the outset and the end of their argument. And at the end of the initial closing argument, the prosecutor argues that this statement by Mr. Parra, is this a rape case, is evidence of guilt. That's the final thing. And I quoted the argument at page 41 of my opening brief, and it clearly draws an incorrect inference. And I've cited the court to Fierro and Walker, and this has to do with the integrity of the judicial system.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Lord. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what's our standard review of the Fierro issue? Was it preserved?
The, asking the question, there was an objection preserved. When the detective answered in a way that was misleading, the defense lawyer brought to the court's attention that she couldn't cross-examine without going into this prejudicial information about the sex offender registry and all the information that did imply it was a sex assault. The court, you know, would not reconsider. And, you know, it's really interesting, Your Honor, in Fierro and Walker, the court stresses it's not all about the astuteness of counsel. You know, it's really about the integrity of the judicial system. And I think the lack of an objection during closing argument follows, really, from what the court ruled on during the introduction of testimony. And it's not right when a prosecutor, unfairly relies on redacted material that would undermine their argument in a critical way. And we know it's critical because it's the last thing said by the prosecutor to support his argument of guilt. And I see I'm running out of time, and I would like to save some time for rebuttal. I would just take 1 minute, because I know Your Honor wrote Rogers. And I'm asking this court to reconsider that decision in terms of how an individual should be instructed on second-degree kidnapping. And the argument is set forth in the brief. It was not responded to at all by the Attorney General's office. And if the court has any questions on that, I would be happy to respond. But it's basically a plain language argument. And by instructing the jury in the way that the court did, and this is plain error, but it goes to a critical element of second-degree kidnapping, the court told the jury that they could find second-degree kidnapping based on any movement, no matter how short. And that's not language found in our statute, and it lessens the burden of proof on the critical element that the victim be carried and seized from one place to another. It takes that requirement and makes one place to another, aspiration requirement, you can prove it by moving a foot. And the problem with this jury instruction was relied on by the prosecutor in their closing argument when they said, look at that definitional instruction. Second degree kidnapping is simple. You force someone to move, but it's, you have to force someone to move from one place to another. And it really is a plain language argument. The instruction that was used in this case, the definitional instruction for carry and seize, has not, prior to Rogers, ever been approved by a court. And it's actually contrary to Harlan, because Harlan disapproved the language that aspiration required an increase in danger, that the movement caused an increase in the risk of danger. And the Supreme Court said that's not in the elemental statute, that's not part of the language of the statute, and it would be the court defining the statute when that's the legislature's job. This is sort of the flip side of it. Nowhere does the legislature say carry and seize from one place to another, no matter how tiny that movement. It's not in the statute, and it's a fundamental problem with the jury instruction. And I'll save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Of course.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Gillespie. I'm with the Attorney General's office. My registration number is 26109. I'm going to, again, like Ms. Lord, because of the number of issues, I'm going to just take the issues as she's presented them and respond to some of the commentary. The jury question that was made, that was asked during testimony, I disagree that it is an abuse of discretion or that it was preserved by any objection. I think when the court looks at how the issue unfolded, the redactions that were requested in the defendant's interview videotape were requested by the defense. There's nothing in the record that they requested that first statement by the detective to be taken out, that this is an investigation about an assault case.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Gillespie.
Sure.
As I read the record, the court told the prosecutor and defense counsel, you go off and redact this thing. And if you've got further problems, you bring them back to me. And I could not find in the record where anyone brought additional problems back to the court about that redacted.
And that's correct.
Is that correct?
That's my next statement. So the redactions that they asked for were taken out. The court had that discussion with them about go do it, whatever you can't disagree on, come back to me. That was never done. The videotape is then introduced into evidence and played for the jury. At the end of that, the jury question comes in for the court. And the question is, during the course of the interview with the defendant in Casper, Wyoming, did you indicate that it was a rape investigation any time before the defendant asks you if it's about a rape? So throughout the opening brief and in the reply brief, defense counsel says, you know, the jury asked if it was just out of the blue, if it was precipitated by anything. But when you read the transcript of how this came in, I think, Judge Hawthorne, you're correct. That's a correct statement of what was provided in the videotape. Prior to the defendant asking if this conversation was about a rape case in Denver, which is what he told him he was investigating, the detective never said that what he was being asked about was a rape case. He was told it was an assault case. I also would point out to the court that the statement that the detective makes about it being an assault case is about 14 seconds into the videotape. There's some discussion, the discussion about the Oklahoma case and the registration is about 3 minutes in. It's not until 7 minutes into the interview when the detective's changed topic and is now talking to him about his brother who lives in Denver that the defendant stops him and says, is this a rape case? I would also point out that when the parties were discussing the question that was going to be asked, the objection that the defense said was to, and I quote, as to number two, I would object in that again. There are portions of that that have been redacted in the video. I feel especially the Miranda, I think the Miranda issue, and that's referring to the fact that a few minutes later he invoked his right to not speak anymore. So again, defense counsel kind of ignores the nature of the objection. So at that point, the trial court then rules on that objection and says, I don't find that anything in that question is asking for anything about his invocation of his Miranda rights, so I'm going to allow the question to be asked. At that point, the question's asked, the detective answers it. And at that point, defense counsel, again, doesn't really object. She just tells the court that at that point it's going to be difficult to cross-examine without going into this other information. So at no point did they ask for a limiting instruction about any of the information that they were concerned about. There was no specific objection that this couldn't come in. There was no objection to the jury question. And even after defense counsel then talked about the difficulty in cross-examining, the trial court said, that was not your objection prior to the question being asked. Any other questions that you want to ask the witness based on that? So everybody, you know, the trial court's interpretation of that discussion prior to the jury question being asked was it was a Miranda issue. That was the ruling of the objection that the court gave. Defense counsel didn't stop the trial court at that point and say, wait a minute, it's not just Miranda. I have these other concerns. So I think if you look at all of that, under a plain error standard, there's nothing reversible and nothing overly prejudicial to that. I think it's an accurate statement of what took place. When in the opening brief and in the reply brief, defense counsel says things like, you know, well, he could have asked that question, he may have asked that question because of the discussion about the registration. It's not this court's job to speculate on why that could have been the defendant's comment. The question is, was there any misleading information? There was not. So I think important is the nature of the objection, the standard of review, and then the timing of where that information comes in. When he asked about the rape case, it was after they had already moved on and started discussing his brother and whatever relation that had. The prison garb, the shackles for the defendant, again, that's a plain error standard of review as related to Jeremy Parra, the brother. There were discussions once he was brought in on that failure to appear warrant. They're in chambers. They're asking about whether the trial court brings it up, whether or not he needs to be handcuffed when he goes in. Defense counsel doesn't say anything. Ms. Lord was correct. I attributed it to the defendant, which actually was a little more beneficial to them, but it was the DA that then brought it to the court's attention that the leg shackles were on. Again, there's a discussion about it. Nothing from the defense attorney about, wait a minute, I want to have those taken off. I want a change of clothes. I want handcuffs. And then there was never an objection after the testimony. So the trial court was never really given the opportunity to address any prejudicial argument from the witness being in shackles or handcuffs or in prison garb. And as I think it was you, Judge Hawthorne, that pointed out, there's nothing in the record. Defense counsel makes a couple of comments in closing, but there's nothing in the record, I'm assuming because there was no objection, and so no record was made, that he appeared in the handcuffs. According to the deputy's response to the trial court, he was going to take the handcuffs off because they didn't believe he was a flight risk. There's nothing to indicate that the prison clothes were on him or that he was in shackles. So I think, again, it's important to pay attention to the nature of the objections, if there are any that are being made. So under the case law that talks about more specifically the prison garb, I think the defense counsel had an obligation, if he was concerned about that, to bring it to the court's attention and to make a record. And then as far as the prejudicial impact of it, I just remind the court that this was a prosecutor's witness that was testifying. He didn't actually, the crux of his testimony didn't really seem to sway one way or the other as far as being supremely beneficial to one side or the other. As far as the...
Pardon me, counsel. I'm sorry for interrupting. Ms. Lord, I think, contends that what this actually was is, yeah, it was the prosecutor's witness, but this was the defendant's brother. Mm-hmm. And the suggestion that Ms. Lord makes is that this is a suggestion of sort of familial criminality, that, you know, the defendant in this case came from a family of criminals. Could you respond to that for me, please?
Well, I think, first off, the most obvious response is there was no objection. So at least according to defense counsel's perceptions at the time, it wasn't something that was significant. It actually appeared to be something that the trial court noticed, the DA noticed, they had addressed, and at no point during those multiple conversations did defense counsel ever say, hey, wait a minute, I'm really worried about how this is going to be looked to be prejudicial. My recollection was the same as Ms. Lord's. I don't think that the trial court ever advised that Jeremy Parra was in custody, but the DA at the start of his question, because it was a hostile witness, did say, you're here, you failed to appear. So it was clear to the jury that it was a question of him. If he had the shackles and everything on, it was a result of a failure to appear warrant and not necessarily any criminality or criminal conduct. So I think taking into consideration the standard of review and the issue, I don't think that that assumption or speculative prejudice would be enough or even finds any support in the record at all for it. The next issue I want to address is the kidnapping. And Ms. Lord's correct, I apologize to the court. Based on the length of the brief, I did not separate out as a separate subheading the instruction issue on the kidnapping count. And that was my oversight. I would point out to the court, though, that my argument on the sufficiency of the evidence kind of subsumes that. In the cases that I cite to Harlan, and then Owens and Rogers that is cited that defense counsel talked about, those cases are all very clear that definitional instruction on seized and carried is appropriate. My argument was, it was clearly substantial movement in this case. So the issue that there wasn't enough movement, the idea, as Harlan and some of those other cases that we both cited talk about, that idea of an increased risk of harm is more for this court to look at when you're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence. In this case, this woman fell asleep in her living room on her sofa bed. Defendant breaks into the apartment, grabs her, puts a knife to her throat, and drags her from that room where the door, outside door and the windows are, into a back bedroom where he ties her up and rapes her. So in this case, I think the sufficiency of that second degree kidnapping is clear. The facts that I outline in my brief that go through that, there's just no question that there was sufficient evidence to support that finding. And if you go through CeCe's testimony and then the detectives and the police officers who took photographs of the scene, there were two bedrooms in the back of the apartment. She was dragged into a back one. The bedroom was dark as opposed to the living room where she was pulled from, which had Christmas tree lights and the balcony lights out on it. So she was removed farther away from the entrance to the apartment. And I think that is sufficient for the second degree kidnapping and substantial movement. If the court doesn't have any other questions on any of the other issues, I don't have anything further to add. Thank you.
Ms. Lord, you have a bit over a minute.
March 19th, 2010, at page 236 and following is the portion of the record dealing with Jeremy Parra. The evidence is not all that clear that there's sufficient evidence of kidnapping. It's a very, very small apartment. The prosecution or the attorney general in arguing that there was sufficient evidence didn't cite to the record. I tried to find substantiation and I couldn't find the substantiation. The alleged victim said that it was a very, very small apartment without a hall. That being said, you look at the definition that's given and you insert that definition and for seized and carried, and not only is it grammatically nonsensical, it would read any person who knowingly means any movement, however short in distance, any person from one place to another. So that's nonsensical. But when you look at that language, what can it mean? Any movement, however short in distance. And if I might finish my sentence.
Please do.
And I would refer the court to Owens, a case where the Court of Appeals found, Judge Daly writing for the Court of Appeals, found that there was sufficient evidence of carrying and seize and significant movement, but also found that an erroneous instruction on that element required reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. We appreciate them very much. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Please go safely home today. With